Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we are talking about pilot training, past, present, and future. I got to thinking about this topic a few months ago when I acquired a World War II era open cockpit biplane trainer, which folks generally call a Stearman. Now, flying at home, I thought about the challenges I experienced in my own pilot training and also reflected on what it must have been like over seven decades ago for those who would have headed off to pilot training to fly and fight in Europe and the Pacific. It occurred to me that challenges facing the Air Force back then mirror macro conditions we are seeing today. Point blank, we have far too few pilots and we need to produce a new generation of talent fast, and we need a lot of them. So we are here today to discuss what it takes to produce an Air Force pilot. We'll examine what training elements are timeless. And what I mean is what themes are common between a young airman who strapped into a Stearman in the 1940s and a student pilot today. On the flip side, what are the key areas where new approaches and leveraging technology offer different vectors for progress? And the imperative for this is simple. The demand for air power is on the rise, but without enough trained pilots, airplanes sitting on the ramp are just bricks. It takes highly trained airmen to strap in and fly the missions. The Air Force has been stuck with too few pilots for too many years now, and it's really causing problems. And there are a lot of reasons for this. Budgets have been tight for a long time, and the pipeline is backed up from starting and stopping pilot productions from things like 9/11, sequestration, and issues driven by a geriatric training aircraft inventory. Add to this the hiring boom from the commercial airlines and cargo carriers, which see a lot of Air Force pilots track to the civilian sector. And things are tough. We are stretching the pilots we have too far, trying to meet a surge demand, and even that's not enough. Now, we've known about this shortfall for years, and the Air Force is trying to implement new solutions, many driven by technology. But there are also some realities where it's going to take sitting at the controls, shooting approaches, a lot of touch and goes, practicing maneuvers, and learning through straight up experience. Now, think about it like this. Do modern Olympic runners benefit from things like high-tech new shoes? You bet, but they still have to go out and pound the pavement every day and run, just like runners have done for centuries. There are some constants about us as humans that are enduring. To this point, do you know that the FAA requirements for a pilot license has not changed in nearly 80 years? And there's a reason for that. Learning the basics takes real-world practice. And a while back, we had the opportunity to meet up with Colonel retired Bud Anderson to discuss his time as a fighter pilot in World War II. He's a triple ace, and his memory of flying and fighting is incredible. Now, here's what he had to say about his pilot training experience.
I'm there, really magic thing happened. The government had a subsidized program to teach young men how to fly with no obligation, you know, whatsoever. I got a private pilot's license while I was going to my second year of college, and flew an early model of the Piper Cub. So I'd got my private pilot's license exactly 35 hours, and you passed or failed. And that's still a requirement today, is 35 hours for a private pilot's license. But the average, I think the average is about 70 hours for pilots today.
So from World War II to today, there are still some fundamental pilots need to gain for basic flight proficiency. And we need to be careful that we don't cheat this as folks advance through their various stages of training, while also ensuring we can harness technology in areas where it will up our pilot production game. So to baseline you on how the system works today, I've got Major General Larry Stutzring from the Mitchell Institute here today, and Stutz commanded a training squadron during part of his career, so he knows how this works.
Hey, Slick, it's great to be back.
So Stutz, walk us through the basics of both what you and I went through pilot training from the Vietnam era to today. It really hasn't changed much.
Well, Slick, let me begin by saying that pilot training is not just about flying an aircraft, and it's not just about earning, you know, prize silver wings. It's a total training enterprise. And at the end of the so-called training pipeline is a combat aircrew. The goal there is fighting and winning the nation's wars. So the enterprise basically has several parts. These newly minted pilot candidates mostly coming from the Air Force Academy and ROTC programs, head to initial flight training. They learn how to fly in a small, slow aircraft. They acclimatize to military training. And in some cases, some are screened out, not able to fly. They go from there to undergraduate pilot training. And this is where, at the end, they earn the silver wings of an Air Force pilot. And from there, it's not over. The next step is to a formal training unit, and then on to the operational squadron for mission qualification training. So all these pieces are related. The undergraduate pilot program, for example, establishes skills needed to effectively train in the formal training unit in a combat aircraft. So let me get more specific to your question about pilot training, which undergraduate pilot training is what we call it, or UPT. It begins with a phase of academics before the students fly. And in that, they learn about the aircraft. They learn about basic aviation ground training, emergencies. They go to simulators, and then they're off to fly their first aircraft, which is the T-6 Texan. And in that aircraft is, no kidding, the fundamental skills of taking off and landing safely, flying in the weather, going cross-country, flying formation. And after about 6 months and about 90 hours of flight training under their belts, students are then tracked. Now, in the early days, everybody went through the same experience. But halfway through pilot training these days, you're either tracked to be a fighter and bomber pilot, so you fly the T-38, or you track into the T-1 aircraft, that's a Beechcraft 300, I believe, for tankers and airlifters. And if you're going to go into a turboprop aircraft, you go down to Corpus Christi. If you're going to fly, for example, a C-130, or you go to Fort Rutger if you've been selected to fly a helicopter, the UH-1 for the U.S. Air Force. And at the end of that track training is when they actually earn their silver wings as an Air Force pilot. So for the most part, this has gone on for about 80 years the same way. There have been some changes, but the academics, the emergency procedures training, simulators, getting that air under your butt experience, which gives you that airmanship needed to be a safe pilot and a smart pilot, after about 200 hours or so, that's been going on. And at the end of that, you receive what's the equivalent of FAA certification as a private instrument and commercial pilot.
So Stutz, where's the problem with this system? Clearly it worked for you and me, along with several thousand other Air Force pilots.
Well, since World War II, there's been three dynamics affecting undergraduate pilot training as we focus on that. One is there's always shortages of pilots. We saw it in Korea, we saw it in Vietnam. And so the Air Force is always trying to surge pilot training. It's got a 2,000 pilot deficit right now. The second dynamic is budget. Pilot training has always been underfunded, and it's resulted in a very aged and small infrastructure, both the aircraft and the bases. The third dynamic is it's not imported technology, even though technology has advanced quite a bit. If you go to a pilot training base today and you went through like I did in 1980, very little's changed. It's almost the same place. The technology has changed, and the dysfunction there is that downstream in the training pipeline, they're having to do, say, at formal training units, training that should be in undergraduate pilot training. So with the budget squeeze, with the pilot shortage, with the need to increase the level of training in UPT, Air Force finds itself in a place where it's looking to technology to perhaps replace flying hours and shorten the training to get more pilots out the door.
Well, Stutz, I really appreciate the perspective. Thanks again for being here. So the question is this new approach to training and leveraging technology giving America's youngest pilots enough experience to fly on a clear day, let alone when in harm's way under fire? All right, joining me today to discuss the evolution of the United States Air Force's pilot training program is the 19th Air Force Commander, Major General Craig Wills. Now, he's an incredibly experienced fighter pilot with thousands of hours in the F-15C, D, and E. So, sir, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Well, sir, we've really tried to bring folks up to speed regarding the pilot shortfall faced the United States Air Force. But in your view, how do you see this challenge?
Well, I think it's a significant challenge. You know, we have two real imperatives. One, we've got to produce the world's best pilots. We've got to produce high quality aviators that are ready to take the fight to the enemy. And at the same time, we've got to produce them in relevant quantity so that our Air Force can continue to thrive. And we know for a fact that we're 1,900 pilots short or so. About half of that shortfall is in the Guard and Reserve, about half on active duty, and then half again of that active duty shortfall is fighter pilots. So the challenge is real. And against the backdrop of a booming economy and major airline hiring picking up, we know that we have a significant challenge ahead.
Roger that, sir. So are there any other factors that are driving these issues that you've noticed?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the challenges that we face. There's many, many facets to it. But fundamentally, the biggest, you know, driver of all of this is that over the years, we've consistently underproduced. And so we're in a position now where we have to retain a fairly high number of the people that we've produced. And that just becomes a very difficult challenge as time goes on. And so I think every airman that we have is a dedicated airman, which is awesome and it's outstanding. But the fact of the matter is that we've got to find a way to produce high quality pilots in sufficient numbers, or we're going to have a much more difficult challenge ahead.
Sure. Yeah, that all absolutely makes sense. And, you know, one question I want to ask was how you see the solution taking shape in the Air Force. And, you know, what does Pilot Training Next 2.5 look like compared to the classic model that, you know, many Americans may be familiar with?
No, that's a great question. And the fact of the matter is that there's not just one solution to what we're up against. We know, as I mentioned, that quality is the first factor. And so we've got to make sure that our pilot training systems are relevant. And the simple fact of the matter is we've done a not very good job over the decades of modernizing pilot training. If you went back to pilot training today, it would look very, very, very similar to the day you started, you know, a few years ago. And so that's a challenge. We've got to make sure that we're cutting edge. And then the second piece of it, as I've mentioned, is you've got to make enough of them. So there's not one solution. UPT 2.5 is one of basically eight major efforts that are ongoing. And, you know, that is the part of the initiative that is most focused on the quality of our pilots and integrating the lessons from our Pilot Training Next experiment. Things like quality instruction, improving the quality of our instructor force by providing the developmental opportunities that we sometimes have failed to do, student-centric learning, use of immersive technology, digital backbone, cloud-based content, those types of things, in addition to incorporating human performance models, which are so important. And then, of course, immersive technology, which is the part that gets all the headlines. But UPT 2.5 is the first of those major initiatives, and that goes after the quality. On the quantity front, we have a number of other initiatives, such as Helicopter Training Next, where we free up slots at fixed wing training by returning our rotary wing pilots to a rotary wing only track. Things like the accelerated path to wings, where we use the T1 for a T1 only track of training, the alternate path to wings, a means to leverage the great aviation accredited universities to leverage some civilian flight training. The civilian path to wings, the idea that there are very highly qualified civilian pilots out there that might want to come in and serve their nation in a different capacity, and how can we take advantage of that? And then, of course, technological solutions like remote sim instruction, whereby we could teach some of our simulators potentially from different locations. We know that some of the places, the amazing places in America where we train pilots like Columbus and Laughlin and Vance, you know, not everybody wants to retire in those communities because they're small towns. And we understand that. But what if we could teach some of those sims in a high quality way from Colorado Springs or Denver or Phoenix or wherever people like to live? And so those are the types of things we're trying to get after to really make a difference. And it's going to take a concerted effort across all of those different areas in order to make a real difference in both quality and quantity.
Well, sir, you're definitely blowing me away here because I had no idea about a lot of those initiatives that seem to make a whole heck of a lot of sense. You hang around an airport long enough, being a fighter guy or whatever, and you talk about your experience in the Air Force, and a guy says, "Oh, I wish I would have done that." And leveraging a civilian trained pilot to come in and be able to fly on an accelerated track sounds great. One of the other things I know that, and you talked about what gets the headlines, is the new pieces of technology that you're harnessing. So, can you talk to us about what some of those are? What they do and what they're trying to replace?
Absolutely. And so, when I first heard about Pilot Training Next, I was sitting in my apartment in Baghdad a couple of years ago. And, when we first began, I think that there became this myth out there that the Air Force had this idea that if you put a VR headset on your head, that somehow it would automatically replace hours and hours and hours of pilot training. That's simply not the case. The technology in many ways, it's an evolutionary part of what we do. It's in some ways not the most important part. The most important part is probably the ways that we're incorporating adult learning models, the way that we're building the syllabi differently to count on things like instructional systems design to find better ways to teach. But there's no question that the tech is important. And so a couple of real easy kills. The first one is let's use things like virtual reality and augmented reality where appropriate to provide better learning tools for students. When you went to pilot training, we gave you a poster to put on your wall, a checklist, and we told you to use your imagination. And that's great, but it's 2021. And so we have tens of thousands of people all over the world building their own simulators at home and using actual digital and virtual tools to learn. Why can't the United States Air Force do the same? And so we've built these low-cost simulators. We call them immersive training devices. It's basically using a gaming computer, some tailored software, virtual reality headsets, and we've gone through about four or five generations of headsets in just the last couple of years alone, and then incorporate things like force feedback stick and rudder pedals into these sleds. And all of a sudden you have a low-cost simulator that instead of you sitting in your chair staring at a two-dimensional poster that's in black and white, you're actually sitting in a low-cost simulator that fairly accurately represents the flight characteristics of the airplane. And it's a game changer. That alone is a game changer. Talk about something as simple as 360 video, that you put a headset on and now all of the traffic pattern references before you've ever set foot in the airplane. And then you add in something like Pilot Edge, which is a service we use where real live air traffic controllers control you in the virtual space around your home traffic pattern or anywhere else you want to be. And so you're practicing in the virtual space with an airplane that feels like an airplane, talking to a real live traffic controller, and then through your headset, you can see the actual traffic pattern references. Some people want to fight this and I just can't understand it. I mean, it's amazing. And what it really adds up to is that we're able to get more quality training out of the hours we spend in the air. When you went to pilot training, you soloed probably between 10 and 15 rides into the program. And today it's routine for students to solo as early as 5 rides. And the window is really 5 to 10 rides. And so that's a 5 ride swing in the ability to teach advanced concepts. And so that's why the tech really matters. When you think about things like your content, instead of just having a checklist, an excerpt from the pub or the tech order to study or an old PowerPoint briefing, imagine that you can put on, again, the VR headset, and instead of drawing a picture of the fuel system for practice, you can jump into the fuel system. You can see when a leak develops, where the fuel drains out of, and you can see the pump shut off and the circuit breaker pop, and you can go through the checklist and throw the switches and watch how your actions affect the systems. I mean, this isn't radical. This is how people learn in the 21st century. And so it's about time your United States Air Force moved in this direction.
Sure. And of course, sir, I think back to T-37s and I, still say, two leg, one shoulder, one chest, lap belt, servo key, zero jelly inliner connected, mm-hmm. on normal, good blinker, good pressure. How about you, sir? Right. So as long as those things aren't going away, but it's a different way to make sure that that rote memorization is intact, I think that's probably the big fear that everybody has when they give the pushback.
Well, so people are just terrified, people are just terrified. I actually had somebody tell me, you're not going to stop issuing the posters, right? It's like, no, relax. The posters cost like 10 cents a piece. We ordered 1 million of them. We'll still give out the poster. You still have to do the work. And that's the thing is you can take a student that doesn't want to do the work and you can put them in the virtual reality all you want to. They're not going to progress. But the question you have to ask yourself is, do you want to put modern tools in the hands of our modern fighter pilots and our air mobility pilots and all the rest of us? And the answer is yeah. And this isn't just for pilot training. This is air battle manager training, CISO training, RPA training, sensor operator training. It's the 21st century. You know, we owe our airmen relevant tools.
Absolutely. So, sir, I know that the program is still pretty new, and you have graduated a fair number of airmen through the various elements of these different training programs. So what kind of grade do you give it so far?
Yeah, I think we're up to about 9 total classes that have graduated at between Vance and Randolph. And I think, you know, generally speaking, I'd give us a solid B, trending upwards. And really, you know, I think that based on where we're at, I'm pretty pleasantly I'm pleased with where we're at. When you talk about a machine, that one of the problems we run into is that all of our graduates in later years assume that pilot training was really, really simple. But actually, the longer you're around it, the more you realize the complexity involved with a machine that produces at this scale. So the fact that our team at Randolph converted from doing strictly pilot instructor training a little over a year ago to actually cranking out undergrads and turning them into graduates, and our team at Vance pivoted a year early to the UPT 2.5 system, I think it's going pretty well. So B, and I think improving, we're now on our second version of the UPT 2.5 syllabus. I'd say it's about 50% better than the first version was, because we've incorporated, frankly, hundreds of inputs from our IPs and from the folks who are using it. And so it's things like ironing out the check ride flow, and it's making sure that the progress check and elimination check procedures make good sense. It's things like making sure that the IPs have better scheduling tools in their hands. The new syllabus is a lot more flexible. A lot of your listeners will immediately say, aha, there it is, they're ruining pilot training because there's flexibility. But the fact of the matter is, the flexibility isn't to make it easier, it's actually to make it more demanding and to allow the instructors to demand more of students that are capable of doing more. As opposed to when you and I went through, the best bet for you and I was to pray for no wins, a close MOA, and a simple profile. And every student's dream was to get those three things and then to fly well on top of it. Nobody gets away with that anymore. We're expecting folks to adopt challenging profiles. We're asking our students to refly and change up the plan a lot more in flight. And frankly, we're just expecting more because our students today can deliver more. And so, bottom line is I'm pleased with where we're at. I think we'll be a solid B plus here within the next couple of months as we fully implement the new syllabus. And then, of course, you know, we won't be satisfied till it's an A+, but that'll take a little bit of time. Part of that is to continue to field the newest versions of the immersive training devices. It's getting that content that I talked about fielded, which is very time consuming to make the content. It's easy to brief the content. It's harder to make that relevant content. And it's just continuing to iron out the procedures. So all in all, I'd say we're on plan. I'm very pleased. The feedback from the field, you know, all of these students obviously haven't made it through FTU yet, and that'll be where we get really solid feedback. But the feedback from the teams at Vance and Randolph is that they're proud of the graduates they're producing. And the check ride, by the way, just to put it in perspective, sir, for some of your more mature readers that remember, that harken back to a different time, the check ride today out of when you finish the T6 portion of the program is a 2-day check ride. It's 3-hour ground eval, 4 hours of graded mission planning, and the next day you blast as a 2-ship to the MOA. You do a 2-ship formation, formation together. You split up, do single ship work in the area, and then you proceed to an outbase. You land, you replan, and you do a navigation sortie back home, and that's one check ride. And so it's pretty demanding. And on the day that you finish, you know, we're dealing with an actual pilot, because the thing that's different today than when we all went through training is you have to put it all together on one ride. That was never true before. You could finish on a formation ride, you could finish on a low-level check ride, but today nobody graduates UPT 2.5 unless they can put it all together on one ride to the right standard. So we're really proud of the program. There's no question there have been some growing pains, but I feel supremely confident that we're producing great graduates out of this program.
Awesome. Well, I mean, obviously a continual improvement process is there. So I'm just curious to what are some of the main lessons learned as you talked about, you know, growing from the B to an A+ that you've experienced working on these new approaches.
Yeah, I think the first one is something we all say, but it turns out to be really, really true, which is change is just hard. And it's not because our folks don't want to change. In fact, quite the opposite. The team at Vance and here at Randolph has really taken this on. But there's 1,000 details that don't always show up in a headquarters briefing, but at the line IP, they feel every one of them when they're out of sync, you know? And so the difficulty in changing a very well-established system can never be underestimated. So I think we've had that reinforced, but our airmen lead the way. And as long as we listen to them, life tends to be pretty good. A lot about enablers. We knew that things like providing sufficient network access, sufficient access to Wi-Fi, getting the scheduling tools right. We knew those things would be important, but over the last 14 months or so, we've really seen that you've got to get the critical enablers in place. And the fact is that a lot of our UPT bases, just like a lot of our Air Force bases, the comm infrastructure and the IT lags behind where it should be. So, IT and those types of digital tools are really key to this transformation. So we've had that reinforced for us. I think trust with the airmen remains that it's not something we didn't know before, but it becomes a lesson that's just worth repeating over and over again. You've got to listen to the airmen when they talk to us. We've got to have an open mind to the feedback. Some things are panning out, frankly, exactly like we thought they would. And then in other areas, we're finding out, hey, we made certain assumptions that weren't quite right. And so we've had to adjust courseware in certain places. And, nothing catastrophic, but just little gaps that when you're a student, you'll find them right away. And so I think just keeping up the feedback loop with the field, being responsive to changes and being willing to adapt have, continue to be the lessons that we learn over and over again.
Gotcha. Yes, I'm sure the feedback from the students, other than, rocking my shoe, Doug ate my homework, is now, and my Wi-Fi was down all night, so I couldn't study. So,
it's really amazing. The students, what I would say is that the great thing is the nice thing when you start something new for an airman that's never been through pilot training, they don't know any other system. So it's kind of nice. But the feedback is this is a challenging program. And I think that's good. I don't think you can, the goal is not to, hey, go design something that's super hard so everybody washes out so you can claim you have a great program. That's not really the right way of looking at the problem. But the fact is that the attrition is up significantly right at the moment. I expect it'll come back down a little bit as our IPs and our students get better at the new system. But we've got a fairly demanding program, and we've got some work ahead to continue to make it good.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I wanted to clarify, and you mentioned it earlier, but can you talk to us about why the kind of pilots that the military needs is, they're different than what you might see in a civilian track? And of course, we both know that they're both good. They're both highly trained. But, for example, strapping into a supersonic fighter and launching into harm's way is totally different than, being an airline pilot, for example. So the demands are more than just hopping into a full motion simulator and things like that that the airlines do use. So can you talk to that a little bit, sir?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the elephant in the room, and this is one of those things that reverberates around the Air Force, which is there is this perception that all of a sudden we've replaced all of our flying training with VR, and that's just simply not the case. We're using the VR as additive tools. The T6 portion of the program has been completely redesigned. The syllabus is completely different. It's not the old T6 syllabus, but then you get wings. It's a completely redesigned syllabus. And then on top of it, we added some flying time, but in addition, added 100 hours of VR content. And so for those of your listeners that are out there that still think that we've just gone completely into the sim, that's not really the case. I know that's not what you're saying, but I thought it worth mentioning. Beyond that, I think the difference between us and the other folks is that we're going to expect people to operate in incredibly high tempo situations with the ultimate stakes on the line. And so when you talk about our airmen that are landing in a dirt strip in the middle of Afghanistan in the middle of the night with an airplane that weighs hundreds of thousands of pounds, and you have one chance to do it right, that's a different kind of an environment that we're training people for. So the discipline, the preparation, the exacting standards, those are the things I think that really set us apart. And of course, the willingness to put yourself in harm's way in a scenario where you simply just, we know that in training, we can always call it, knock it off and come back another day. We also know we're going to send graduates out there where that may not always be the case. And so I think that the stakes are just a little bit higher in general. And I think the discipline and fortitude require a little bit more. I also think that we expect more in the terms of thick skin from our military aviators than potentially it is. Now, I have to say, in fairness to all my airline pilot friends, I've never been an airline pilot, and I don't know what it's like to be a civilian pilot. But we know for a fact that most airlines aren't going to require a 4 to 6 hour debrief after you make the Chicago to Newark leg. It's a different kind of a flying. And so we expect our students to have thicker skin, knowing that almost every day you come to pilot training and every day of your military aviation career afterward, you're going to spend the bulk of your time talking about what you did wrong, not how great you were. And the presentation of trophies portion of our program is relatively short. And so I think the stakes are higher. The skin needs to be a little thicker. And frankly, we owe a higher degree of professionalism. And again, not to take away from my friends that fly for the civilians, there's some great civilian flying outfits. But if we want to be the world's best, we've got to be the world's best. And that encompasses everything from the way that we treat each other on the ground to the way we execute in the air and the way we debrief when we get back. America deserves the best.
Well, sir, I want to ask you a question about something that you said, you know, and it all kind of ties into how you answer a question. You know, I call myself an old guy since I'm retired, but, you know, so an old guy like me that didn't get their wings until after T-38s or whatever track they went on, it seems like somebody with getting their wings after 6 months and, you know, you said about 100 hours of flying in the T-6, maybe they don't have the airmanship that one would think would be commensurate with United States Air Force pilot wings.
Yeah, so I think this is one of those questions where you have to really think about it in a bigger picture. When you finished your T-38 training, we didn't immediately unleash you on the Air Force. You know, you got your pilot trainings at a stage, and you got your wings, rather, at a particular stage. And what that said is you're ready for the next stage of training. And so that's really no different now. When we finish with the T-6 program, the folks that are going to fighters and bombers still report to T-38s for T-38 training. And we're doing some things to make that training better. But basically what the wings are saying is you have the basic competencies of an Air Force pilot, which again, we've mixed up that, as I mentioned, we've redesigned the T-6 syllabus. So it's not just the old tweet syllabus or the old T-6 syllabus with a different ending. It's quite a bit different. But I think the key point remains the same, is that in both cases, we're putting the wings on your chest and saying you have the competencies and the skills, and you're ready for the next level of Air Force training. When you graduated from pilot training, you weren't ready to go out and conquer the world. You had a certain set of basic skills, and we had a system that built upon those skills, and that's really no different today. I'd argue that between the additive training and hopefully the better ways that we're training, I think the folks that are finishing up in our UPT 2.5 are highly competent at basic piloting skills, but there's no question they still have more training to do. And that's why they get more training before they go on to their MWSs. The other thing I'd point out is that when you look at the historical attrition numbers that we had in T-6s, it was about 7.7% in T-6s over the last 10 years, about 1.5% in T-38s, 1.5% in T-1s, and 0.9% in T-38s. So the fact of the matter is, for a very, very long time, almost nobody has washed out of phase 3 training. The current attrition we're seeing in UPT 2.5 is closer to 17.5%. And so I submit to you that the graduates we're sending on to Air Mobility's fundamentals training and that are going on to T-38 training, I think possess a higher skill level at the current moment. Now, again, I don't want everybody to believe that a high washout rate automatically equates to a quality product. That's simply not the case. At the same time, we recognize we're asking a lot more of the students, and I think the standard will be higher than it's traditionally been.
Great. Well, I really do appreciate shedding some light on that, because I know that's a question a lot of folks have. I know we're getting a little long on time, and normally I would ask for a flying story, but considering who you are, what we're talking about, the level that you're engaging, I have a technology question for you. And I really just want to know what piece of technology that is incorporated in UPT 2.5 that really just wowed you to the point where it made you think, man, if I had this when I was a student pilot, it would have been a game changer.
Yeah, I think it's the immersive training device. I think it's this low-cost simulator that uses gaming computers and VR and basically what was a gaming rig. And we've elevated the art of that. If you saw this 2 years ago, if you haven't seen what we're doing in the last 6 months, you really haven't seen it. But, you know, if you think about in the old days, chair flying, you were limited by your discipline and your creativity. If you were disciplined enough to ignore whatever else was going on in your life and lock yourself in a room and chair fly for a couple hours every night, and if you were creative enough to imagine that two-dimensional poster was an airplane and imagine those visual cues, then you were successful. And now we have this simulator that, you know, at the low end of this thing, we spent $8,000 on the early versions. And I think the common immersive training device we're working on now is somewhere around $25,000. But when you put it on, it's pretty amazing. And what it's allowing you to do is I used to look at chair flying as preparation. And now we have this opportunity to really do training. It connects to the cloud. And so if your instructor is available or if it's scheduled, the instructor can climb into the same cockpit you're in virtually, no matter where they're at. During COVID, our pilot training next team didn't lose a single sortie or sim because all of them had sims in their houses. And so you have this opportunity to go out there and see it in a way that's has more fidelity than anything we've ever done. And what that means is that our students are spending hundreds of extra hours practicing. And so you see things like, you know, folks going out and doing a full instrument penetration on their dollar ride. You see this opportunity for people to continue to accelerate. It has limits. You know, there is a limit to the goodness that this stuff brings at some point. But I think it's a game changer when we put tools in our students' hands that allow them to really accelerate their learning. And the goal, again, is not to use it as a sneaky way to cut hours. The goal is to make every hour in the air more and more productive, because the fact of the matter is our U.S. Air Force doesn't have enough money to provide all of the hours that we want to every time from now until the end of time. You know, our new airplanes are expensive and more expensive to fly, which means we have an imperative responsibility to make sure that every hour of JP-8 that we burn is an hour well spent. And the fact is that a lot of these tools allow us to take care of some of the admin and some of the practicing on the ground so we can focus on higher end training in the air. So that's what blows me away is the immersive training devices. It's not the most important. Again, I think the most important thing is probably a different way of approaching the student and building a better syllabus and a better way of learning. But the tech is pretty impressive and getting better every day.
Yeah, it does sound incredible, sir. And again, I can't say thanks enough for your time and answering some of the tough questions that we put in front of you today. So thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for your time. It was well.
Okay, it's important to emphasize that Pilot Training Next is a new program in the big scheme of things, and it'll take some time to figure out what's working and what needs improvement. The biggest thing to emphasize is that whatever we settle on has to work. The Air Force needs these pilots in volume, they need them fast, and they need to be exceedingly competent. So with that, I've got Stutz back with me, along with Heather Penny from our team, to talk through some factors to consider regarding how the Air Force may evaluate the program. So Stutz and Heather, welcome.
Hey, Slick.
Hey, Slick.
Now, we just heard General Will's discussion, and you've both spent years in the cockpit. Give me a quick rundown on the factors you track on this program, and how would we know if it's winning or losing?
You know, I've got to tell you that I went through the exact same pilot training process that you and Stutz did, right? I went through the T-37 and the T-38 with very minimal technology. So I agree with General Wills. I think that the technology they're bringing on board is going to make a huge difference in maximizing the quality of every hour of airtime that they get. But I'll tell you, it cannot replace airtime. And I know this because as an instructor pilot in the Gulfstream, the training I went through was a full-up level D motion simulator. It was exquisite. But when I got students that had just come out of pilot training, had gone through that civilian full-up motion simulator training, and we got them there on the field, putting them in the jet was a totally different experience. They were actually often behind the aircraft, whereas in the simulator, they weren't.
I totally agree with you, Heather, on your perspective. And, you know, this technology can create a better pilot than we've ever had before, not just try to get more pilots out the door, and that's where the focus should be. So I appreciate what you said. But let's talk specifically about metrics. You know, how do we mm-hmm. know whether this is succeeding or not? And I think one of the main ones I see will be very obvious quickly is that at the formal training units and at the operational units, they will stop training on tasks that currently are not being done and should be done in undergraduate pilot training. That needs to be tracked, then trended, and that feedback goes into making a better pipeline.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for example, right now with the F-22, the formal training unit for the F-22 is unable to accomplish many of their tasks. And so it's turning the operational units into schoolhouses. And those operational units are unable to really focus on their combat mission training. So I agree. That's one crucial metric that we need to be looking for.
Yeah, and then another one will be at the operational unit. And as experienced military pilots, we know that we are never going to advance to the next level up in qualification in, say, a tactical maneuver or up to flight lead or up to instructor pilot. We're never going to advance pilot unless we are totally confident they're ready to go. So if this is not working, we'll find that folks are not ready to upgrade, and we'll see many more mistakes, I think.
Absolutely. And so this is both a metric that we'll be able to measure hard, because we'll be able to actually measure the qualifications of these young students and at timelines within their career. But it's also a quality measure. And so we say quality matters, this is going to be something we'll get feedback from the commanders from. And they'll need to be candid and they'll need to be real about the quality of these students.
And in the end, of course, in our business, with respect to being a combat pilot, the results are going to be written in blood, or they will not be written in blood.
Well, I think we're going to have to circle back to this after a while to see how the program is doing. And I sure hope it helps the Air Force turn the corner on pilot production.
Yeah, you know, this technology is long overdue. And, you know, as General Will said, all of us would have killed for this when we were going through pilot training. So, but ultimately, time will tell. And so we have to be on the lookout for these factors to see how this is going to improve the pilot training production process.
I'll second that, Lucky.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.